the Paris Climate Talks in Central New York. In the following hour, reflections on the agreement that came out of Paris, its value and significance, the ways it relates to Central New York. Also, the panel and the public on what people can and should do to impact climate change. Bringing the Paris Climate Talks home, hosted by WAER News and Public Affairs Director Chris Bolt.
Heard a lot of information about the Paris Climate Summit, mainly about the large agreement, not so much behind the scenes. There are many global concepts that were discussed and agreements between nations and things on a very large worldwide scale. Might not be so clear what the relationship is to Central New Yorkers and also the consequences to Central New York. WAER does a fair amount of environmental coverage. Fairly recently, we've covered aspects and gotten reactions to things such as Governor Cuomo's clean power plan, the REV process that's going on, the reforming the energy vision, certainly local things such as solarized CNY, you know, push for more solar power in the area, and of course, many other environmental issues on Onondaga Lake, as you well know, and many other things, brownfield issues. In just a moment, I'll introduce our panel to you. First, we're going to have some reflections on kind of what went on in Paris and reactions to how big a deal it was, how unique it was, what surprises might have been there. We're going to then talk about how we bring some of these issues home, ideas, again, about consequences that might be particular to Central New York. Syracuse is a fairly sustainable city in some ways. New York State is probably more progressive than many other states. And then the final piece we're going to get to tonight is we're going to try to look at and brainstorm some action steps. If you want to do something about this, or if you want to follow legislation or policies, what are those? So first of all, let me just introduce the panel. Johannes Lehmann is a Cornell soil scientist, just back from the Paris talks. He studies greenhouse gases, ways to trade carbon, and as a soil scientist, Johannes is also interested in the effects agriculture choices and agronomy can have on carbon levels. So that's one thing that he'll bring to the discussion. Next to him is Peter Wilcoxon, Maxwell Professor of Public Administration and International Affairs. He's on the EPA's Science Advisory Board, and Pete studies climate change and energy policy. That's included links between environmental and energy policies with the economy and world trade. One step this way is Sarah Prally, Senior Research Associate at the Campbell Public Affairs Institute and studies environmental politics and policy. Her work has recently looked at nuclear power and wind energy. Sarah's also studied environmental organizations and their agendas vis-a-vis climate change. And then closest to me is Bob Wilson, Maxwell Associate Professor of Geography. Bob teaches an introductory environmental studies course, American Environmental History, and has done research on the history of environmentalism and the climate movement. So thanks again for our panel for taking part. Where I wanted to start tonight's discussion is to look back at Paris. It just ended, as we know, Saturday. 196 organizations, or rather countries, signed the agreement. And I wanted to first just pose to the panel, in no particular order, but how surprised were you that we got pretty universal agreement on this climate change accord? Pete, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, I think this was a huge step forward. If you followed the climate negotiations over the last 20 years, for most of that time, the framework of the negotiations has been focused on an approach that really was doomed from the start, where all the countries would get together and try to argue about the exact amount of carbon that each could emit. And this particular negotiation took an entirely different form, as you may know. The countries that were negotiating each submitted a promise, an intended nationally determined contribution for what that country felt it could put on the table now to reduce emissions. And I think that was a huge breakthrough. I think this is the beginning of what will be a much more successful way of negotiating over climate going forward. This is the basic model that's used for international trade negotiations that's worked for many years. Countries come into the negotiations. They say what they're able to do politically with their current constraints at that time. You know, this is not going to be enough to solve the climate problem, but it provides a foundation for people to build on. And then they come back to the negotiations a few years later and do a little bit more. And by doing that, I think we're going to move forward. So,
when I saw this conference coming up, actually, I didn't have very high expectations because I've been watching this over so many years. And then also seeing what happened in Copenhagen, where there was enormous optimism on what could be accomplished. And I would say that that last conference in 2009 in Copenhagen ended in failure. So my expectations were relatively low, and so it was very encouraging to see what came out of this conference.
I guess I would say I wasn't completely surprised, in part because the Copenhagen was, I think, was seen, rightly so, as such a huge failure. And there was this political pressure, I think, to not do that again. And I think the key point in getting there was when the Obama administration met with China and made an agreement. I mean, without the U.S. and China on board, being able to, you know, make a commitment to these other countries, it was never going to happen. So I think that event, when that happened, that's when my hopes for Paris, I got more optimistic about Paris, because the other countries were not going to listen to us preach to them yet again about how we have to do something about climate change when, you know, we or or China were unwilling to do anything. So a number of things had shifted since 2009 that made me hopeful that they couldn't go home without doing something significant.
And then, Johannes, I know you were there, and I know, as you said, you were more on a behind-the-scenes and scientific level as opposed to being a negotiator. What was the mood like? Was it tangibly different?
Yeah, I thought so. I was both in Copenhagen and now in Paris. Copenhagen being dubbed Hopenhagen, and it was anything but Hopenhagen. It was a miserable experience. And being in Paris, it was much better prepared by the host country. Everybody was much more focused on getting a small step, but a tangible and a real step forward. And Copenhagen was, we needed to solve it now because the Earth is doomed, but there was no real notion of how to achieve that.
Now, as you said, kind of a step forward, how much of a step forward is the agreement versus just being kind of a step that we know we're coming back for more negotiations? How much is this significant moment in history versus just a first of many steps?
We, in the long term, have to eliminate fossil fuel use. It's going to be a very long road. But now we're on a road that actually can lead to that. And before, we were in a zero-sum road. We were in a world where we were going to be arguing how to split up a fixed pie, and that makes developing countries like China and India have a very hard time coming to the table and agreeing that their emissions will be limited forever. But now we're in a world where they can say, we can do this now, and in a few years we can go back, and they say, can you do more? So I think it's a road that's going to lead somewhere.
I think it's also it was an opportune moment. We had a change in leadership in Canada and Australia very recently, and those have been very vocal opponents in the last few years, and that helped tremendously to pave the way, in addition to the U.S.-China initiative. So it was a bit of a point landing in there as well.
But people were saying we're at a turning point in 1992 in Rio. And then we said we're at a turning point in 1997 in Kyoto. And then we said we're at a turning point in 2009 in Copenhagen. I'm encouraged to see the differences with this one as opposed to the conferences and meetings that have come before. But, I mean, there's a lot remains to be seen in the coming years. And whether a lot of these goals that we're aspiring to, whether they're going to be achieved in many countries, but including our own, which hopefully we'll come back to, about what may happen if with the next election that's coming up in our own country.
I think it's to be determined whether this is more in line with, okay, yet another attempt that didn't go anywhere, or this was the beginning, and this was sort of the floor, and then we just keep building on it. I mean, the fact that it has no enforcement mechanisms is a problem, right? And that it doesn't have firm, you know, commitments about keeping fossil fuels in the ground, right? Are we just slowing down the burning of fossil fuels further? Or are we really going to get to the point which, you know, Pete which I agree with, obviously, is that, you know, stop using them entirely. You know, there's no sanctions if people don't meet their goals. And we know that voluntary, you know, regulations in this country don't really work so well.
People have sometimes been very hopeful about previous agreements, but all of the climate negotiations going back to COP1, which 20 years ago, up until now, have been focused on deciding on what the pie is of carbon emissions and dividing it up, and then hoping that some kind of international carbon police would come along to force countries to do what they said they were going to do. And there was never any hope of having that kind of organization come along at the international level. So that's why I think, even though this is a weak agreement, it's not going to get us to 2 degrees, there's a lot more to go, it still is using the institutions we've got, right, national governments, instead of trying to create some kind of international enforcement mechanism.
Johannes, you were there in sort of a scientific. What else went on there in terms of, again, we saw about the countries agreeing to the overall accord that ended up being signed at the end. What kind of other things were going on sort of in the scientific community that might even be hopeful to say, hey, here's who's working on this aspect of what might mitigate climate change or something else?
Yeah, no, there's a lot going on, and now, you probably know the numbers of staggering tens of thousands of people, and only a fraction of that is negotiators. There are a lot of so-called observers, but still, there were a lot of youth organizations there. They were prioritizing youth organizations, students that got there. I think we are creating a culture and a community that cares about these issues, from youth organizations to academics to civil societies. And they become more informed, more vocal, and can contribute to the discourse, and I think exert some pressure. And you feel that, because the negotiations happen literally 50 meters over in that building, and then across the hallway are the observers and the civil societies, and they mingle all the time, and it creates a community, and that's really very exciting to see how that grows. I see a lot in my area of land use and land management, agriculture, a lot of interest to contribute to lower emissions and withdrawing carbon. We probably all realize that just by emission reductions, we will never get to 2 degrees, let alone 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. So we need to withdraw carbon from the atmosphere, and we need to reduce emissions from agriculture. To pile on the complaints a little bit, is that the term agriculture and soil did not appear anywhere in the final text. Forests appeared, but agriculture did not. Although that's, as in terms of land use, that's the elephant in the room, but was completely ignored. But again, I think that's must be the next step, and there's so much interest in that. A lot of organizations have staged side events specifically to land use and land use change, as both mitigating an issue of greenhouse gas emissions, but also an opportunity to withdraw carbon from the atmosphere.
And then the last thing, and I don't know, maybe Sarah or Bob, this is in your area, is it did seem like activism had a role in this conference. I mean, I heard at one point that one activist group actually was showing videos inside the negotiation area of, like, the Marshall Islands, you know, partly underwater and other severe climate change impacts.
Now, I would say that there were some aspects of the climate movement that were developing in places such as the Global South and in South America and South Asia and Africa, but the difference is that there's a much more pronounced role of activists in places such as the United States that are contributing to this. And so there's, I think, more of a consequence for not accomplishing things on climate change, because there's going to be a more of a pushback from the grassroots. As I think many of you would know, and certainly my colleague Sarah probably could talk about, is that climate change has been an issue that actually many Americans are concerned about, but it has low salience. It is not a priority for people. And when you rank, you know, what are the most important issues affecting the country, like here's a list of 15, climate change is dead last. And whether it's internationally, nationally, or in our own personal lives, mm-hmm. if something's number 15 on the list, we tend not to address it very well. But I think it's increasing in salience and then also becoming more important for a number of different groups, especially the youth, and hopefully that's something we can talk about as well, the role of youth both here and internationally involved in climate activism.
What's going to drive the domestic policies? It's going to be the activism, I think. So I think, again, for the activism, although it's gotten, you know, it's ramped up in the last 5 years, again, that has to be the floor for activism. Yes. And not the ceiling for it. Mm-hmm. Because going forward, it is, if these countries are going to keep their commitments, it's going to be due to continued pressure. Not only is global warming the low priority, the environment, period, is one of the least salient issues. And then if you look at within the environment, global warming's dead last within environmental issues for Americans. So it's even worse than we think. And I think the weeks during the Paris climate talks were a good example of how tough this is going to be moving forward. We had the mass shooting in San Bernardino, and I was watching the news and listening to the radio, and the Paris climate talks got a little bit of coverage, but you'd probably agree with me. I didn't do an empirical analysis of it, but it seemed like that issue and terrorism was just flooding the media's coverage of it. This was the biggest climate news in the last probably 10 years, but you have this mass shooting, and it's kind of like the American public's like, yeah.
I'd like to now bring this back, to Central New York as much as we can. It's a lot of issues. It's big things. It's the world we're talking about, et cetera. How should people think locally, seeing Paris go on, and we can be optimistic if we want to, and we can know that there are limitations of that agreement and how it will go forward, but how can we think locally in terms of what goes on there that's going to impact us here?
Well, I'm going to answer it slightly differently, maybe, than the other panelists.
Sarah's off the track.
I actually don't think there's going to be like immediate like impacts that are noticeable at this point. But I think going back to my issue of activism, I think what can happen is that people can organize in our congressional districts. And since we're in a congressional district that is, flipping back and forth between Republicans and Democrats, we can be a wedge into the potentially Democratic Party by putting a lot of pressure on Representative Katko to not go with his party and to start get over their resistance to talking about this. And the fact that Katko did not vote with his colleagues to against the Clean Power Plan, I'm going to say that maybe that was due in part to some of the activism within his district. And so I think that's a great place for us to sort of focus our energy here.
And we also have some examples from, at our two universities. SUNY ESF is now committed to fossil fuel divestment. Syracuse University committed in part to fossil fuel divestment in terms of two relatively large institutions of higher education committing to that. I don't think there's anything like that in the entire world right now. And so there's been an enormous groundswell of activism, I think, in general in the community and on our campuses in particular that was absent a few years ago. Students becoming aware of this issue, are organizing on this issue, and seeing that they have a stake in this issue in a way that wasn't before. That was literally an academic issue to them that they would kind of learn about in a classroom, and then they would kind of wipe their hands of it, and they would sort of go on their way.
I think it's going to be really important for people to be very active, and I think what you both are saying, in very active in supporting our congressional delegates in Washington, because there's going to be a lot that needs to be done to make this commitment by the U.S. work. So right now, the Obama administration has some of the building blocks in place. We have increasing vehicle fuel efficiency standards that will help. We have the Clean Power Plan. The Clean Power Plan, which for anyone who doesn't spend their whole life looking at climate policy, is a policy that will reduce CO2 emissions from existing power plants. It's a key building block. If Power plants are the source of 40% of U.S. carbon dioxide. To control the problem, we're going to have to reduce emissions from those power plants. The Clean Power Plan is going to be litigated and contested in Congress, probably not at the level of the Affordable Care Act, where there's every week a vote to repeal it. But it's gonna really need the spine of a lot of people in Congress to be very stiff to keep that policy in place. We're going to have to just keep talking to people in Congress that this is something that we understand and we want. It's going to mean that energy prices and electricity prices are going to go up, and that's going to have to be something that people are ready for.
I mean, the fight is what's coming next. I mean, that was not the fight there. There's going to be, I imagine, a ferocious fight as we move on in the months and the years ahead, whether we're going to implement that. Because I think there's a lot of interest who have absolutely positively no desire to go forward or to comply with this. So I think there's going to be a struggle.
The thing that I think is really important to have on the table that comes out of the research that I do, so I do a lot of work looking at the economic impacts of different climate policies, is that we can do this. So the kinds of policies that we're talking about here that would bring U.S. emissions in line with U.S. pledges will they will not be free. It will cost something, but it costs a very manageable amount. So the kinds of studies that my colleagues and I do show that fully implementing these agreements could mean that by 2050, we won't have the same GDP we would have had without the policies. Instead, we'll get 2050's GDP in 2051. So we can do this for the cost of 1 year's worth of economic growth spread out over 30 or 40 years. It is doable. It is definitely doable, but it's going to require political will and courage. And ultimately, that comes from us, right, as voters.
And it is up to all of us, all of you, to engage with that. Waiting for the politicians to wave the magic wand will not do and will not happen. There's always only change happen from the bottom, and it just needs to happen. And I would also wish that Cornell students are going on the street and demanding from the Cornell president to divest as well, or take massive action towards reducing emissions and becoming carbon neutral, as university made a commitment to that and accelerating that path with concrete steps. I think change our behavior as well. Lead by example, and move down that path, taking that inspiring step for Paris further right away without losing momentum.
I mentioned touched upon this earlier, about we don't have wildfires like the Northeast or California doubling its wildfire season. We don't have the threat of rising sea levels. We are not experiencing drought. We probably have had some change in crop behavior, but nothing like some areas that used to be, you know, valuable growing areas, and now they're not. We haven't seen any of those kinds of things. How much of a problem is that to assert the urgency to, you know, follow any of the tones of voices that you people just shared with us?
I think it's a major issue, and partly because I think we've framed climate change in particular ways. We've talked about it in terms of economic impact. We've talked about the politics. Other people have talked about it in terms of justice issues, how relatively poor parts of the world, say like a country like Bangladesh, that is both poor and very low-lying, is going to be affected by sea level rise. And so you look at a place like Syracuse, like, well, we live inland. We're not in the American West that are typically exposed to wildfires. You know, we're also inland, so a hurricane or storm of that magnitude is not going to affect us. But I think the way that it will affect us in a place like central New York is different. In my discipline of geography, we have this concept called place. And a place is an area where we have an emotional investment that we think and we value it in particular ways. Going the decades forward, if it warms as much as we see with climate models, this place is going to be a lot different. I mean, our winters are going to get shorter. And so what we're seeing now, and I'm not saying what we're seeing outside the door, or that it was 71 degrees in Buffalo, or that trees are blooming on the Syracuse University campus, that that's because of climate change. But looking forward, what will happen is what we think of winter here will get shorter. We will get, the snow season will get shorter, we'll get more rain, and this place will just be different. Our summers will be hotter as well. It will still be living in central New York, but the way that maybe for some of us who've lived here or some of us who grew up here, this place will just seem a lot different. For some people, maybe you think that's a great thing, that our winters will be shorter. Other people who value some aspects of living here and that are dependent on certain climate conditions, that's going to change. Are you okay with that? Does that affect you emotionally? I think that's the way it's going to manifest itself in our communities in that way, rather than thinking of it just in terms of kind of economic impact.
Now I'm happy to open this up to the audience at this point and, you know, both share maybe how you as Central New Yorkers related to what was going on in Paris or the issue in general, or see this connection to some of the impacts, again, that we might not suffer the worst of, but that we are seeing some changes, and then we can portend, greater changes down the road. I know there's some research on the Adirondacks and how different tree species might change, waters that contain certain types of fish might change, as trout won't be able to live in the habitat. So I'd be interested to know in the audience if either there are questions about these kinds of things or your experiences or relationships to them.
One of the local issues that we're facing in central New York is the probable closure of the nuclear plant in Oswego. For some people, that's a terrible thing. For some people, that's a great thing. It does, however, raise the issue of energy futures for central New York and what role, if any, nuclear might play in that. And I know that there are environmentalists who come down on both sides of that.
Yeah, well, so I think when we get serious about climate and, you know, hopefully the Clean Power Plan is in operation and we maybe have moved on to tighter carbon limits, we will probably regret closing any nuclear plants that didn't need to be closed for safety reasons. Nuclear is carbon-free. It doesn't require the sun or wind to be blowing. You know, all the things that you read, that you hear about in the press about nuclear are true. It's very reliable, and, you know, that's we will probably regret that. Now, at the same time, the plant is closing not for any sort of malevolent reason. It's just very hard for them to make money when natural gas is very, very cheap. And so it could be the case that we have this natural gas boom, last for a few years, then, you know, natural gas can become more expensive and we may regret having mothballed the plant. So
I think if we had ramped up our, you know, solar and wind and other alternative energies, you know, 20, 30 years ago, maybe we could get away without using nuclear. I mean, you might know better. But I think partly the problem is we've just waited so long.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to transition in the time frame in which all the scientists are telling us we need to transition, it seems to me at least has to be part of a mix, in the short term at least, as a kind of transition. But I know the environmental community is divided over it. And I think it does speak to like a larger problem of kind of local reaction to energy infrastructure. And although we see it much more pronounced in the case of nuclear, I mean, you even see it in the case of wind plants, right? Or wind farms, right? So there are a number of small towns around New York State that are passing noise ordinances, which are basically an attempt to keep out wind farms. So, you know, and this is happening, even though the New York State is I think, like number 11th in potential for wind energy across the country. So I think there are going to be these local fights over infrastructure, and the part of the politics is, you know, it's difficult because these decisions, the local communities do actually have quite a bit of control over zoning and things like that. And I if we ramp up alternative energy to the point where we have to, you know, we're going to have to be comfortable with seeing a lot of these windmills and other infrastructure around.
Yeah. So my personal reaction to this, I lived in Germany in 86 during Chernobyl, and we were told not to go outside, and we thought maybe in a week or two we don't live anymore. So my visceral non-scientific reaction to that is, there are dangers, and those people, whether it's Fukushima or others who have lived through that, they have a different perspective on this than somebody who has not had these experiences. I would always think it's not a long-term solution, and that maybe it's a stopgap measure while we transition. But there's always the argument, if we have that fallback, now then we don't make the earnest effort to transition very quickly. And that's the same with shale gas and everything else. So I believe we can do it. We just need to move forward and not sideways. But I'm not an economist.
There are way more groups accomplishing way more than I can actually say, but I know we have a group that was Solarize Syracuse and was so successful that now it's Solarize Central New York. And so what they do is get a bunch of people to say, yes, we want solar, and then you get a deal. You get a lower price for everyone to install it. So there's a lot going on here. I couldn't quite hear what you were saying about natural gas being lower emissions, and I'm not sure if that was one of your points, but as we know from the fracking fight, it's not, because of all the fugitive methane, and methane just, it produces more methane, which is more potent a greenhouse gas. So, I mean, a lot of analysis have been done, and it's not a positive alternative. It may seem cleaner at the point where you burn it, but when you consider the fracking releases so much methane, and methane leaks out all along the way, that it turns out it's not a benefit. I think the east side of Onondaga Lake, I mean, Lake Ontario, it's constantly windy there. It's constantly windy. And you could have a really good offshore wind area, and then it gets to storage. We've heard the day, night, and the wind not blowing for solar and wind, but the whole energy storage thing is in transition right now, especially what like Elon Musk is doing with Tesla and the Tesla batteries. I think we're really getting to the point where we will have solved the storage problem, and we won't need to worry about that.
I mean, the point that brings up for me is that are these things, the amount of wind that we have, the potential for wind, which has been mentioned a couple times, are these big, significant steps? Are these game changers? Are these the things New York local people should be behind, not just conceptually, but are they there to make a big enough impact? I think the point about natural gas was that natural gas is very cheap now, so it's hard to move into alternative energy because natural gas power generation is very inexpensive. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, one thing building on that, for a while natural gas was talked about as a bridge fuel. And yes, when you burn natural gas, it produces less carbon dioxide per unit of energy than coal does. But as you correctly mentioned, one of the concerns about natural gas is fugitive methane emissions. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. But I always found like this whole bridge metaphor is actually wrong. I mean, bridge, you start building both sides and meet in the middle. But, we're building like the natural gas on one side and it's going to get us to the other side. It's not like we have like some sort of Uber plan that we're building the other side. So we're doing this and then we're building the wind farms and we're all planning it. That's not actually how it works. And so you just have natural gas and that will just become dominant for a long time until it become so expensive. And so the sense that you're going to have natural gas as a bridge fuel would sense that you're kind of working on the other side of this, I don't know, canyon and building like renewable energy on that. But we're not doing that. We're not doing it. In many ways, that the low price of natural gas has actually made it very difficult for renewables.
Well, one of the things that does make it have a bridge-like characteristic is that about 10 years ago, electric power companies in the U.S. built about 250 gigawatts of new natural gas combustion capacity. That's a quarter of the U.S. generating stock, and it's very lightly used. So there are issues about how much natural gas is released when natural gas drilling occurs and in pipelines. But if we can control that, We have already built enough natural gas plants that we could take coal offline. Otherwise, that's a probably $300 billion investment project that's already been made. So gas gives us an opportunity to start taking coal offline very fast, much faster than we could build new wind turbines and new PV units. So it could, in a sense, be a bridge since the capacity is already there. And coal produces twice as much CO2 when you burn it per kilowatt hour of electricity than natural gas. So that's where natural gas got its reputation. And there are, to be sure, these issues to do with its extraction. But in terms of actually producing electricity, it's much better. And not only that, it doesn't produce a lot of the other problem pollutants that coal produces. So everyone's probably familiar with the situation in China, which is desperately polluted with coal byproducts, particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide. All those have very serious health problems, too. So in terms of, like, things on the to-do list, burning less coal should be pretty high on the list.
Hi, Dale Sherman. I work in weatherization, energy efficiency side, as well as energy education. And one of the things I've heard a lot about is renewable energy, but very little about the efficiency side of things, both in our residential and commercial buildings, industrial processes, transportation, general infrastructure. And I can tell you that the low-income weatherization program in 30 years in New York State of doing weatherization work has only reached 17% of the eligible homes in New York State. There are still thousands and thousands of homes across just New York that have zero insulation in them. I can't help it, but that is the cheapest fuel you can get is to not use it at all. So, and we're not really addressing it. Now, if any of you have been in attics and crawl spaces, there's nothing sexy about weatherization. It's not like solar at all. I was in Sweden in 1979 working there and realized that 8-inch thick walls, triple pane glass, in 1979 in Sweden was the answer to our economic security, reducing our trade deficit, increasing economic resiliency in this country. And, oh, by the way, it takes care of that other nasty ill called climate change.
And I think it's another, yet another argument for a carbon tax, right? Because as we raise the price of electricity, the incentives are going to shift for homeowners to invest that money in efficiency so their bills go down. You know, and do other policy incentives, really smart incentives that help people pay for those over long periods of time, get it folded into their, you know, utility bill.
Well, from an economic point of view, having a carbon tax would be a terrific policy because a carbon tax makes it more expensive to burn fossil fuels. It doesn't make anything else more expensive. So it provides all the right incentives for getting people off of carbon. And it also provides an incentive for people to use less energy in places that are very carbon intensive by investing in efficiency. So that would be a great policy. But that's pretty much the third rail of American politics, that three-letter word, right?
Yeah.
So it would be great. It's a big lift.
It's a little disappointing that we're hearing that gas is part of the solution here. Switching from one fossil fuel to another is not an answer, even if it were better. But there are two professors at Cornell, Tony Ingrafia and Bob Howarth, who have done studies for about 5 years now, peer-reviewed studies, that say that burning gas is worse for climate change than coal because of the tremendous methane leakage. We have a situation out in Southern California right now where there's this huge methane leak that's increased the methane leakage in California 25% over the last month and a half. Gas is not a bridge. It's worse for climate change because of the methane. And we really need to get off that. That's how Chesapeake bought the Sierra Club, and it's just not an answer.
Well, it certainly is a problem if you do it wrong, okay? It certainly is a problem if you do anything wrong. And so the question that we really have to ask for natural gas is, do we really believe it's impossible to do it right, to drill for it without fugitive emissions? So if you think that's technically impossible, and you think that the fugitive emissions are high, then we'd have to avoid it.
Well, but we seem to have naturally moved over to action ideas, so that's fine because that's right on schedule. So, you know, I'd like to hear people's ideas about things that either you are doing, things you think people could do.
So New York has the possibility of becoming a leader in the whole country around becoming carbon-free and nuclear-free. And my concern is, and this is what I'd like the panel to speak to, is that Governor Cuomo not only is saying that nuclear could be part of that plan, and not only that it's green, he says it's carbon-free, which it really isn't if you look at how much carbon it takes to mine it, enrich it, and dispose of it. He not only says it's green, but he says it's clean, and it's not clean. Not only because of Fukushima and Chernobyl, but also because of the hundreds of thousands of people in the world who have died from radiation poisoning at every stage in the nuclear chain.
Can't respond to the governor's plan, but what I wanted to say is that not everything has to be about economics and pay for itself. It's also a value judgment that what we as a society want to do, how we want to live, and how we want our future to look like. And it doesn't have to be the cheapest solution. It's the solution that we feel is right. And if it pays for itself, that's great. But I don't think that is the end-all and be-all of the discussion.
I guess my worry as a political scientist is that the progressive movement or environmentalists are going to kind of battle each other over these particular energies. When I think at this point, because we've waited so long, we really need to present a unified front and focus on getting a carbon tax, as well as other things. A carbon tax alone will not do it, but it's going to be a major step towards getting us where we need to get. And in some of that, then, you know, natural gas will then not be able to compete as well, right? And so then there might be reasons why we get off those. But I'm afraid that if environmentalists are fighting among each other about particular technologies, you know, while I agree with, you know, I especially agree with the anti-fracking activism, that I think the time has come to focus on the national scene and getting a carbon tax. I mean, I sound like a broken record here.
What's
well,
a
that's
record?
Why I shout out to the Citizens Climate Lobby for focusing on that.
Well, there is the state by state requirements of the Clean Power Plan, National Clean Power Plan, can be different in every state because of each state's realities. Mm-hmm. Governor Cuomo's Clean Power Plan or the REV process involves a lot of different moving parts. I mean, you sound like you're a little concerned that there's, you know, we have this paralysis by analysis where there's probably 50 ways to come up with those plans. Somebody has to kind of decide on the end goal first and then figure out what pieces go. No one's going to agree with all of those. We can't, what's the phrase? We can't lose the good for want of the perfect.
I would love for the panel to weigh in on the magnitude that individuals adopting a meat-free diet can have an impact on the environment.
If you can do it, that certainly is a very positive step. So meat, and especially cattle, are very CO2 intensive. And if you are okay with a plant-based diet, that can be a very significant step forward.
But I would say, and this is one of the things we talk about in some of our classes, is that so we present that, and that's very true. And it's kind of focused on the individual, like making that decision or not. And I think it's, at this point, a relatively moderate number of individuals are willing to make this choice. The challenge comes is when you kind of wrap that up and try and provide a whole set of incentives for people to eat less meat. I know on some college campuses, for instance, they even introduced Meatless Mondays in a more kind of, I don't know, maybe aggressive manner than we've done this at Syracuse University. And the pushback against this at other institutions from students has been actually quite remarkable. They're like, who's going to tell me whether I can eat meat or not?
not only are wind turbines facing resistance, but so are solar panels. And it's not just because of noise. I mean, 2 days ago in North Carolina, which is a place where there's a lot of potential for solar panels, the issue was tabled because people were afraid that solar panels were going to suck up the sun, the solar energy. So I think that the denial aspect that we're going to be facing on every aspect of this, how do you deal with with people that are, up is down and, water is dry?
Well, I would say just a basic issue, and I'm sure a lot of other panelists have said, but we just need to realize, if there's one basic kind of lesson we get from the history of energy development over the past 200 years, they come with pros and cons for different approaches. And you often get resistance to different types of energy in particular localities. As good as we think something like wind or solar might be, you would expect resistance to develop it. And some of that might seem kind of unfounded. But some of it, in places such as the Southwest, wanting to put solar panels over large sections of particular parts of the desert, there are people, even environmentalists, who are wondering if this is this a total good? Because what effect does this have on habitat for endangered, say, tortoises in the Mojave Desert? That we need to realize if we're making such a massive change in energy that might involve wind farms or solar arrays in different parts of the country, you can expect some resistance to that.
What I guess I'd really like to focus on is people's maybe positive or ideas, and perhaps to give people more ideas of action steps that we might take.
So my name is Lindsay Spear, and I'm a Free Lakes Regional Coordinator for New Yorkers Against Fracking. And I'd like to invite people to pay attention to what's happening across New York State. There's been a variety of communities that have been rising up against the fossil fuel build-out that's happening. We have banned fracking in New York, but we haven't been able to ban the pipelines that are coming through the state, often trying to take the fossil fuels for export. We haven't been able to ban the storage facilities. And I was actually at a meeting in Albany amongst many of the different grassroots groups this past weekend, and there's a real effort to come together and help collaborate amongst those groups. But you'll see across the state there's opportunities to stand up, particularly coming out of Paris, particularly noticing that the nationally determined contributions are going to fall far short. And it's actually recognized in the Paris Agreement that the NDCs that have been put forward are going to result in about 4 to 5 degrees of warming, far short of what the 1.5 goal is in that agreement. So it comes down, as the panel's been saying, to the people. And we can stand up and say no more fossil fuels. There's a lot of action happening around Seneca Lake right now, and I encourage people to take a look. I've been involved for many years in the issues around the cleanup of Onondaga Lake. And as we pushed for a full cleanup of the lake and a return of the species of fish that had previously been there, we used to have Atlantic salmon. We used to have brook trout. We used to have lake trout in that lake. All of them are cold water species that require cold water to live in. Now, part of the reason why they can't come back is because there's no oxygen in the bottom of the lake, which is where they normally would hide when the water gets warm. But the excuses given from those who are planning the remediation about why they couldn't plan on cold water fish being here ever in the future was climate change. And so climate change was used as an excuse to limit a cleanup of the lake.
One thing people can do is familiarize themselves with the Gibson Environmental Stewardship Resolution. This was a Republican initiative. It recognizes the reality of climate change and pledges to do something about it. 4 representatives from New York State are co-sponsors. John Katko has not made a decision yet. So you can write a letter, call, or send an email and urge him to co-sponsor. He is not a hardline Republican, and we need bipartisan solutions to this problem.
Chris, I see in the back Chris Carrick is from Solarize CNY, and just since it's been such a nice success and We've done some attention on it with WAER's reporting, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to at least talk about that.
So I'm with the Central New York Regional Planning and Development Board. We're a public agency representing the five counties of Central New York. We were instrumental in starting Solar ICMY this year. And I just wanted to point out to folks that earlier this year, the Public Service Commission implemented a new policy called Community Distributed Generation that really opens the door for local control and local investment of our renewable energy resources. It's really the culmination of what I hoped to see 20 years ago as a grad student at UC Berkeley. This would allow things like a solarized campaign to invest in shared solar systems or solar gardens so that folks no longer have to worry about whether they can put solar on their own roof. They can invest as a subscriber in a shared solar array that can be intelligently and strategically located so that the utility actually benefits as a whole. So we're very excited about this. I think everyone should be excited about it. It opens it up to low and moderate income folks in a way that owning their own solar system on their own roof never could. It also opens the door for community wind projects, like the Black Oak project that we saw going in Enfield, where communities can invest in small wind farms that are appropriately sized and scaled for their communities that actually offer an opportunity for local people to invest in that project and make a return. What we've seen is where communities can benefit financially as a whole from renewable energy, there's much less resistance.
And you're confident that if these community solar projects get built, they won't suck all the solar energy out of these areas?
So I travel very often to Central Europe, and I'm actually frustrated by the lack of adoption of these available technologies in this region of the world. When you look in Central Europe, practically every farm, every barn is packed with solar panels. There are wind farms all over the country in Central Europe. There's really no excuse technologically for not adopting these. I think there needs to be a much greater push. And this is only the available technology. There is so much more we can do. We can invent a lot smarter technologies than we already have at hand in terms of avoided emissions by making houses reduce their emissions and be more efficient with energy use, as well as generating energy. Clever ideas of harnessing wind and solar with new sensors and new wind turbines on every house, those are opportunities that we haven't even tapped into. But without the right incentives, we're not making the progress that we need to make.
The difference in Europe, really, the carbon tax that the individual users have to pay, they pay four times the amount for gasoline. And so that's the incentive.
Yeah.
It's been a deliberate act by the part of the government to incentivize that. Yes.
Okay. Educate. Sitting in this class, both my wife and I are, she's an earth science educator also. We've got to teach these kids, starting in K and going all the way through 12, so they become an intellectual intellect when it comes to climate. In Albany right now, we're going for our NGSS, Next Generation Science Standards. And what that has in it is a tremendous amount of climate, where kids will actually do hands-on work, data set analysis. If we do that, we will achieve solarize, wind, all the alternatives, in a much more cooperative atmosphere for all of the different communities that we have discussing energy education and climate change.
I'd like to circle back to the panel now. We're kind of out of time, but I'd like to just circle back to the panel one last time. And how do you think about people moving forward and actions people can take, or just being more aware of something that you guys might be aware of?
A problem that I've certainly seen over the past 20 years has been, over the past 20 years, a sense that we're going to deal with this as individuals. We are going to consume and individually recycle our way to a better society. These are wonderful things. I practice this myself. But the sense that we're just going to buy something a little bit different and we're going to recycle as individuals a little bit different is not the primary way to address it. These are larger structural issues that basically what we've been talking about, and it takes, you know, groups coming together, putting pressure on elected officials and forcing us to think of politics, economics, and technology in different ways. And what I'm most encouraged by is not like this conference or that bill, but this sense is that, yes, collectively we need to work to address it. And now I'm beginning to see a change around that, and I think that's very encouraging.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the collective action part is really key and something that is on the upswing and going in the right direction. I would add, though, that, you know, I went to the climate march and it was wonderful and empowering and a sight to see. There was not one banner that I saw, and I didn't see a lot of it, but about the Clean Power Plan. It's boring, right? It's like an EPA rule, but it is the most significant thing that this country has done around climate change. If it actually goes into effect, would have the most significant effect. As activists, we have to do, you know, we have a big charge, and we have to do all the what we're already doing, but also have to get willing to get into the kind of boring, you know, right. Policy. Not for me, boring. But I, you know, policy wonky type stuff. And, you know, and support these things and speak out about it. I mean, that is where the opponents are focusing. That, you know, there's many state attorneys general who are litigating against the Clean Power Plan. And there's not a lot of counter pressure to that. And so I hope that the activism continues and grows to get involved in some of these less, you know, exciting movements as well, because I think, you know, we need the next president and the next administration to do this Clean Power Plan.
For my 2 cents worth, I try to avoid letting the Clean Power Plan be dynamited. It's a good first step. But my suggestion is support pricing carbon through a carbon tax or a tradable permit system. Turning over the U.S. energy sector, as I mentioned earlier, we can do it, but it's going to cost on the order of $2 or $3 trillion. And that money is going to be spent by people who have to make a rate of return. They're legally obligated to do it, people who run power companies and other things. So it's going to have to be profitable for them to do it. And pricing carbon will make that happen. If we don't price carbon, it's going to be impossible to get investments of those scale, of that scale, mobilized. So support the Clean Power Plan and ask for more. Ask for a carbon tax or a permit program.
There has to be engagement by all of you, by all of us, at the political level, and force and encourage these changes. Otherwise, it will not happen. As a scientist, I believe we have a lot more options at hand that we haven't even dreamt up, and we got going on that very soon.
All right, well, I really want to thank you all, panelists, for being here, Johannes Lehmann, Pete Wilcoxon, Sarah Prowley, and Bob Wilson. Also, thanks to the Central New York Community Foundation for hosting the event. Thanks to the CCAA members who helped with both publicizing and a little bit of the groundwork here. My name's Chris Bolt. I'm the News and Public Affairs Director at WAER. And thank you guys all for coming. I mean, it's really... You know, thanks for everyone who made a comment or suggestion, but thanks for paying attention and getting involved and doing something and coming out to something. So thank you once again very much.